I would like to thank the sponsors of the Ledby Poetry Festival, Arts Council England, for all their support, enabling the festival to happen at all. I'm going to introduce the poets in the order in which they'll be reading. So Caroline Smith, originally trained as a sculptor, her first publication was the long narrative poem Edith, which was published by Flambard. Her debut collection, Thistles of the Hesperides, was also published by Flambard and was shortlisted for the Aldborough First Collection Prize. Her work has also been widely published in poetry journals. Her new collection, The Immigration Handbook, published by Seren, draws on her 15 years' experience as an immigration and asylum caseworker in Wembley, one of the most diverse communities in the UK. Adnan Al-Sayer is a major poet from the 80s movement in Iraq. He's been forced into exile twice for writing poetry that denounces oppression and injustice. After being sentenced to death in 1966 as a result of the publication of his poem Uruk's Anthem, a long poem in which he gives voice to the profound despair of the Iraqi experience, he took refuge in Sweden. And since 2004, he's lived in exile in London. As well as challenging dictatorship and oppression, his poetry celebrates love, beauty, and freedom. He's published about 20 collections of poems and selected poems. In English, he's published a chapbook called The Deleted Part. And in September this year, ARC will bilingually publish his first full-length collection in English, Pages from the Biography of an Exile. Adnan has received a number of international awards, and his work has been translated into many languages. Adnan's work is translated by Stephen Watts. Stephen is a poet, editor, and translator with cultural roots in the Swiss-Italian Alps and in Scotland. He's published two bilingual English-Italian works, as well as six collections of poems. He's been a Hawthornden Fellow and was twice awarded second prize in the UK National Poetry Competition. Stephen specialises in working with exiled poets, and he's co-translated work by poets from Iran, Syria, and Iraq. So please welcome Caroline Smith.
Thank you very much for inviting me. I'm thrilled to be here. And I do appreciate the Wimbledon final is on at the moment, so you must be the most dedicated literary audience ever. So thank you so much for coming. Today's Bards Without Borders, and the way I fit into this is that, as well as being a poet, as Jill said, I work as an immigration and asylum caseworker for a London MP, and I live in and work in Wembley. And much of my job involves writing letters to the Home Office, making appeal representations, and holding immigration surgeries, and helping people basically to sort out their immigration problems. And I hear so many different stories and meet so many different characters, and many of them have found their way into this book, The Immigration Handbook. And tonight we're going to hear from poets who have claimed asylum and have been granted refugee status, but a lot of people are not. And the people that come to our surgeries are, on the whole, the people who have multiple immigration problems and have not been granted asylum. And my poems sort of weave fragments of their stories with the difficulties they face through the labyrinth journey of through the Home Office bureaucracy, where people often languish for years and years and years just waiting for decisions. So the first poem I'd like to read is called The Boxer. As if I've moved a board from the grass and uncovered white, straggly, bolted strands, this one-time Russian boxer has emerged after years of hiding. His nose undulates, the tip protruding from his flattened face. His pallid skin shows the scars of fights and drifting, as he gesticulates the story of his last fight in 1997 against Gary Stoneface Henderson, former middleweight champion. A warm-up act in a half-full, blue-lit arena, an unequal contest he couldn't win. How, as his gum shield was removed and water splashed over his swollen head, and as the crowd surged to its feet, roaring the entrance of the hero on the main bill, he had slipped away from his minders, his fixers, and the restrictions of his visa into the urban undergrowth of bus shelters, the shredded Hessian of unlocked sheds. Somewhere in the damp holds of the Home Office, a scrap of paper with his name was lost, overlain with the heavy files of newer conflicts, and the years, like a soothing poultice, began to break down his identity, braille his documents with mildew and the wet black gills of fungus, crumble the pages into the soil he's become a part of. In Wembley, we have over 160 different languages in our schools, and we make up one of the most diverse communities of anywhere in the world. And many people who have come as asylum seekers have no documentation. And the title of the next poem is actually the name of a Home Office form, IS-96, and it's given to somebody on temporary admission. And basically what that means is, we know you're here, but we don't think you should be. But unfortunately, IS-96 is sometimes the only form a person ever gets from the Home Office. IS-96. The refusal notice told him he was appeal rights exhausted. He was. After 11 years on temporary admission, like a shipwrecked survivor staggering up the shore, he had collapsed on the tide's edge to the boom of the sea and the cry of the gulls. With each new refusal, he'd felt the sinking pull and roll of pebbles shifting beneath him, dragging him back out to sea. But as year followed year, and they never made him leave, his fragile hope took root, lacing the bleached crowns of matted grass to the quiet lee side of the dunes among the flat violet stones and brittle bundles of seaweed that drifted across the paths of half-buried sleepers. A few years ago, I transferred my case files to a new computer system and found I had 32,000 pieces of separate correspondence with the Home Office. I don't know what it would be now, but a letter to the Home Office obviously has to show a person fits the rules or has a good case, but it also has to have more than that. It has to have the ring of truth about it, some sort of clinching detail that cuts through all the layers of stories. And this next poem is called The Scarlet Lizard. Nothing moves except the evening light crossing the judge's room. The lawyer's skeleton arguments lay piled on his desk. They seem to him brittle as bleached poppies tapped of their seeds. He longed to see the quick movement of a scarlet lizard weaving unexpectedly through the parched, cracked hexagons of a legal phrase, to hear the snapstick fritter away from a hiding place, to feel the cold diaphanous weed grip in the black current of a border crossing. He needed to sense some quiver of indecision, an odd detail that would open the truth of their words, chinks of light shining through shuttered doors. The asylum seekers that I meet aren't saints. They're both good and bad, with mixed motivations and dreams, like everybody else, like all of us. It's just that they have much heavier burdens to bear. And one of the most acute dilemmas a failed asylum seeker faces after years of being stuck in the system, battling with the Home Office to be allowed to stay, is whether to continue in limbo or to call it a day, as it were, and go back to their home country. And of course, the longer a person stays here, the more they've lost and the harder it is to make that decision to leave. This poem's called Eaton House. Dr. Khan has been walking for 7 years out to Hounslow to join the queue and each week sign his name. He edges forward, his face burning as if he's standing in the marketplace of his home in Paktika province. Word has got back from new arrivals. Even Dr. Khan is in the queue with us. He told his wife he was practicing in England. Every week he has described for her the life he is building. She imagines the slow, steep climb up to the pass, the sun rising over the next ridge where he can see the summit, the skylarks veering from the scrub into blue sky, the crossing point where he's gone too far to turn back. And in my job, despite all the heartache and suffering we see, you have to have a sense of humour to survive, because tragedy and comedy rub very close together, whether it's the misspellings we get in letters, such as, "I was arrested by six uninformed guards," or my bogus lawyers have been liquidised. There is the more sinister humour of Mr. C, who got a visa by promising his brother his kidney, and then once he got there here, he's decided actually he'd quite like to keep his kidney for himself. And this is a found poem, actually, by a judge who obviously did have a sense of humour. It's called Judicial Consideration. In front of me is an arrest warrant, poorly typed, and a diploma, neither on headed paper. Both documents have the same dropped G and the same large gap between lowercase I when it's followed by a lowercase C. I have considered whether two typists could randomly have made the same spacing error using two different typewriters and excluded that possibility. I've also considered whether the poor public services complained of by the appellant could have led the Chief Prosecutor's Office and the University of Tirana to share the same worn-out typewriter, and I must exclude that possibility as well. People migrate for all sorts of reasons, and on my desk I see so much of the world's history and conflicts distilled into people's individual lives and problems. And whether it's the person who can't complete their form because their mixed-race parents 50 years ago married in South Africa and had to leave the name on his birth certificate of his father blank, or whether it's the child who's born on the way from Somalia to Ethiopia as her mother fled and has no nationality. And some people just come to seek their fortune. And this poem's called Domestic Worker. Esther Cunha da Silva had watched the rhubarb erupt through the bare spring garden like a miniature rainforest. Now she levered and pulled and carried in the giant shuddering canopy, filling the kitchen with sharp green breath. She snapped battens, packed her pie dish, sheared off curls of crimson veneer. She heard the screech of falling trees, the echo of chained timber, moving down the river Solimões Amazonas, taken from her childhood home in Manaus. With arms full, she flaps out to the compost, twists off the ill-fitting lid and stands back. A cloud of black gnats billows out, like a clap of dust from the blackboard rubber, in the little school where she'd first heard the stories of their opera house, built by rubber barons so rich they lit cigars with $100 bills. Their brazen wealth, like a dormant seed, had germinated within her, and in time she'd followed the rubber and the timber, left behind the favelas, the depleted rainforest. And whether it's to escape a war or get an education, everyone comes to improve their lives, but sometimes they find themselves trapped in modern-day slavery. And this poem is called Valerie. She was agitated. She should have dressed up for him last night. It was his birthday. He'd asked her to, but she'd refused, and he'd got upset and gone out. Didn't come back until the morning. She should have dressed up. He could dump her, send her back. She jerked the buggy wheels swivelling into the corner as the baby began to snore through its cleft palate, dummy balanced on its lip, thin sky blue hood pulled over its eyes.
She hadn't known she had no visa until she witnessed a fight and came forward. She ended up being the one arrested.
Just a kid she was when she'd come. Her auntie had arranged it. Thought she was coming to school, but ended up slaving for the family. Auntie kept her passport, but didn't do nothing about her stay. An elder at the church had given her the eye. She'd wanted to make something of her life, but it turned out it was the only way.
The Home Affairs Select Committee complained in a recent report that the Home Office uses bureaucratic terms to disguise the true nature of their activities, and this poem is called Selection. He was quietly hopeful when he got the letter that said his case had been selected for progression, that he would be allowed to stay. But then a second had arrived, an invitation to a service event, and he was suspicious. Too much activity, this sudden attention to him. He was scared. It was as if, after all these years of hiding, he would finally be led out with the other men and boys through the fringe of sunlight from the gloom of the pine forest, his hands clasped behind his head. And the government actually has a policy to create a hostile environment for those with no documents, even though often it isn't their fault because they're trapped in a system waiting for decisions, documents get lost. But in contrast, this poem is about generosity. It's called Heron Flats. As you push a leaflet through a letterbox, Abdul Rahman dashes out to petition the case of Zhang Li, who's been sleeping on his sofa for the past 2 years. You ease off the messenger bag and sit and take tea with him on the balcony. You know Abdul, a serial letter writer in green ink. He arranges mint leaves in glasses, and you watch them twist and melt like fur caterpillars, as you sip on this Sunday afternoon up here where the North Circular is constant as the ocean and next door's finches dyed to the colour of flamingos squall in their rows of cages. What you didn't know was how hard it was when he first came to England in 1964 to get a job and how many letters he'd written and how he'd got no replies and then how one day he got an interview for a position as clerk at TL Holdings and how, when he'd got there, he'd found three other candidates, all foreigners like him, and how his boss, Ray Watkins, had taken them all. Those who work in the system, in the Home Office, try and be professional and objective, but sometimes their own backstory comes through, and this story, this poem, I've called The Tale of the Administrative Removal Officer, and it's called The Pilgrimage. As he looked through cases, he often wondered if his own life could withstand such scrutiny. Now checking this man's documents for illegal working, he notes the withdrawal of £5 each Friday night from a cash point in Norwich, at the end of a week lifting heavy turkeys in the meat plant before returning to a caravan he shares with seven others. His balance, £3.92 at the end of 6 months. He felt reluctance, superstition almost, to decide this case. The man had been picked up by immigration on a pilgrimage. He must have known there was a chance officers would be waiting. They had last year. But the man had gone anyway. And now he felt not so much that he was being asked to weigh up this man's life, but that somehow he himself was being judged, still being judged for what he'd done 20 years ago, when as a young, drunken farmer in Woodge, he'd stepped outside the boundaries of his own faith and created his future. But there again, without the drink, he might never have done it, never have got talking to a Westerner, might still be on the farm, slopping swill across the cobbled yard to the shrieking, whinnying piglets pummeling at the teats of the slumped, exhausted sow. Couldn't now, even if he wanted to, return like some prodigal son all forgiven. There was no farm to go back to. He sold it that night for enough dollars to buy a coach ticket out. But sometimes at night, he heard the tick of insects in the long bleached grass creeping gradually over the yard, saw the door hanging off the wooden pen, felt the lightness of the dollars in his hand, the empty space in his life where the pigs had lain, solid as boulders along the ledges of shade, sunken eyes under curled laurel-veined ears, their chestnut hair glinting through cracked olive mud like the copper reliquies of his faith. And I'd like to finish with this final poem called Luck. There's so much chance and randomness in the system, in the asylum system. Two brothers, same circumstances, came together, one allowed to stay, one refused because their case is decided by different caseworkers. A baby born a day outside the amnesty so that its parents can't stay. A Syrian doctor who just happened to fly from JFK Airport to Heathrow on the night of 9/11 for a job interview and has never been able to shake off the scrutiny of his life since. And this poem is called Luck, and it's set on Christmas Eve, because often the Home Office chooses days like Christmas Eve when they think that nobody will be working to deport people. Luck. A sudden deep snowfall has grounded all flights. Mr. Owazu's deportation that we fought so hard against is unexpectedly cancelled. Our faces are grey and wrinkled against the brightness of snow. Boots creak and squeal in the thick silence as we decide to walk these country lanes, quiet again as when my mother and her father, evacuees from the bombs of London, once cycled under the jumbled hedgerows, alive with birds and berries, heading for the canal, fishing rods strapped to their backs. One day they caught a large perch and wrapped it in wet newspaper to take back for supper. She carried it in her basket for the long cycle home. It was still alive when they got there, to their rooms above the post office, where my mother, afraid to sleep, would read under the streetlight. They put the perch in the sink and the next day cycled all the way back to the canal and let it go. They figured it had somehow deserved its luck. Thank you very much.
العراق. العراق الذي يبتعد كلما اتسعت في المنافي خطاه، والعراق الذي يتئد كلما انفتحت نصف نافذة قلت آه، والعراق الذي يرتعد كلما مر ظل تخيلت فواتا تترصدني أو متاه، والعراق الذي نفتقد نصف تاريخه أغان وكحل ونصف طواه.
Iraq disappears with every step its exiles take, and contracts whenever a window's left half shut, and trembles wherever shadows cross its path. Maybe some gun muzzle was eyeing me up an alley. The Iraq that's gone, half its history was coal and song, its other half evil, wrong. Rotterdam, 1997.
سذاجة. كلما سقط ديكتاتور من عرش التاريخ المرصع بدموعنا التهبت كفاية بالتصفيق، لكنني حالما أعود إلى البيت وأضغط على زر التلفزيون يندلق ديكتاتور آخر من أفواه الجماهير الملتهبة بالصفير والهتافات، غارقا في الضحك من سذاجتي التهبت عيناي بالدموع.
Gullibility. Whenever a dictator was toppled from the tear-stained throne of history, my palms blazed up from the applause. But as soon as I get back home and switch on the television, another dictator gushes out of the mouths of the crowd, aflame with adulation. I'm drowned in laughter at my gullibility, my eyes burning with tears. Baghdad, 1992.
يملونني سطور تأويل، يملونني سطورا ويبوبونني فصولا، ثم يفارسونني ويطبعونني كاملا ويوزعونني على المكتبات ويشتمونني في الجرائد، وأنا لم أفتح فمي بعد.
They rush up my lines, split me into chapters, catalogue my references, print the whole works, get me in the bookshops, badmouth me in print, and I haven't even yet opened my mouth.